Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. It's been a big week for us. We've officially launched our subscriber exclusive content. So Monday released a bonus interview with previous guest Peter Bergen about President Trump's foreign policy. And yesterday, Sagar and I released an extended AMA session where subscribers asked us questions and we basically treated it like a bonus discussion episode that I know people like so much. So if you want to actually not only support the show, but also get this bonus exclusive content, go to realignment.supercast.com, click the subscribe link in the description for this podcast, or you can click on the teaser episodes that we released on Wednesday and Monday to get a preview and go to the links there. By the way, tomorrow is Friday, so you'll also want to go check out our Substack, which is going out that day as well. You could find that in the show notes. On to today's episode. My favorite genre of book right now is the We All Know Something's Wrong, What Exactly Happened in This Country bit. Peter Zion's episode on Tuesday gave one answer, which is basically that globalization is breaking down, populations are declining, and growth is slowing down, which means you have everything from the war in Ukraine to soaring energy prices to the supply chain crisis that comes out of all of that. Today's book is another type of answer. It really focuses on the year 2000 as this big turning point in our politics and culture. And by looking at different stories like the dot-com bubble, the 2000 election, aka the question of, are Bush v. Gore, are they really that different? Are the two parties really just sort of the same thing in a different, you know, set of clothing? And then focusing obviously then on Reform Party candidates like Pat Buchanan and, you know, President Trump's nascent campaign at the time, or Ralph Nader. So that brings to mind the discussion of third parties today, and just the broader issue of a contested election that features the Supreme Court. So many different storylines that really matter today are going to play into this story here. So it's really exciting to speak with the author, Andrew Rice. The book is titled The Year That Broke America: An Immigration Crisis, A Terrorist Conspiracy, The Summer of Survivor, A Ridiculous Fake Billionaire, A Fight for Florida, and The 537 Votes That Changed Everything. That's a really long title, but it really gets to the fact that there's five or six really interesting stories going on here, so can't get enough of it. All that said, hope you guys check out all the great work we're doing on the Supercast, and check out the Substack, and of course, a huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Here's the episode. Andrew Rice, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks.
I'm really, really, really excited to speak to you about your book for two reasons. Number one, the year 2000 was actually the year that I first got interested in politics. And by interested in politics, I mean my parents were watching the news hour of Jim Lehrer. I asked who the two men on the stage were during dinner, and it was Al Gore and George W. Bush debating. So once again, these were particularly deep thoughts. It was just my actual interest and awareness. But then two, this is in a really interesting genre, which is this idea of, it's very clear in the year 2022, but something is off in America right now. And what you are positing is that the year of focusing on, you know, about weird state we're in right now should really be the year 2000. So I want to start by asking you about the title, actually. You know, it's The Year That Broke America. Can you define what a broken America is in your conception?
Well, I mean, I think that really a lot of the book is talking about the squandering of the good fortune of that millennium year. So you can look at it in a lot of different ways. I mean, one thing that we, you know, a lot of it is about how maybe we didn't know how good we had it at that moment, and how lightly or carelessly we as Americans allowed that to slip away. So, you know, on the economic front, it was a time of amazing surpluses, trillions of dollars in budget surpluses that just sort of stretched as far as the eye could see. Politically, There was a sort of centrist consensus. A lot of the political debate in that 2000 election was about how to spend this amazing windfall that came out of the economic plenty of the late 1990s. Technologically, it was a time in which the internet was really just kind of coming into being. I think it was a time of a lot of technological optimism about how the idea that the internet would bring people together. And the book opens with the Millennium New Year of 2000, and President Clinton gives a speech in which he talks about how the technologists that he's been talking with about the millennium have been telling him that predicting that the internet would bring an end to war and to miscommunications among people. There was a sort of a blithe idea that by allowing people to communicate more instantaneously and get to know each other better, that the world would kind of come together as one and realize that it's elements of commonality were even stronger than the ethnic and political and ideological differences that seem to divide them. And finally, on the geopolitical level, it was a time in which the U.S. geopolitical dominance was unquestioned, and economic dominance was unquestioned. I mean, in his 2000 State of the Union address, President Clinton gave a kind of unapologetic and unmitigated praise of celebration of globalization as the defining force of that era. And globalization, I think, has since become a kind of dirty word both on the left and the right for different reasons. Or actually, part of my book is about how the left and right actually the marginal forces of the left and the marginal forces of the right at this time in particular had quite similar critiques of the of globalization, but they were sort of considered very far beyond the pale and marginal at that time. And now they've become central to our political discourse. The idea that the trade agreements struck during that time period were bad deals for the American people and American industry is something that you hear, former President Trump saying, is something that you hear the Democratic Socialists saying. I think the idea that our present political moment, when we talk about, I think people from the left, people from the right, I think commonly agree that the polarization of our nation is. That if our nation is broken, it's a function of this political polarization. Well, what I'm saying is that the roots of this political polarization and this cultural polarization, this time in which it seems as if we're constantly in turmoil and no one can talk to anyone about anything, the roots of this can trace back to this really profound turning point in 2000.
Yeah, so much I want to pick up there. So firstly, let's talk about the centrist political consensus, because you're telling a bunch of different stories in this book, but the story that kind of runs throughout it and that I feel appears the most just analytically, this was a terrible take. I think it was a bad take at the time, but every year since then, it's been the worst take ever, has been the idea that the Democrats and the Republicans were the same. This is basically the Ralph Nader argument. This is a lot of the argument that Pat Buchanan, so Ralph Nader is the Green Party candidate, Pat Buchanan is the Reform Party candidate. And very clearly, the second the year 2000 is over and you have a president, you obviously see, well, it turns out that Al Gore didn't want to use that, surplus for tax cuts. George W. Bush did want to use it for tax cuts. There's 9/11. Al Gore would have had a very different response than George W. Bush had. maybe not in Afghanistan, but definitely when it comes to expanding the war into Iraq, given just the nature of people who came in and were attached to the George W. Bush administration. So can you just talk about what made people think, and maybe you think that there was something that was really deeply the same about the two parties, but I just think that was just, I think that was just an incredibly dumb take that really confused a lot of people about the actual choices they faced. Like, how do you think about this idea?
Well, I think it traces back to, as so many other things do, to Bill Clinton. And I think it traces back to a time period in the early 1990s when the Democratic Party came to a conclusion that the only way to win national elections at that time appeared to be to move to the center, to lie differences between the liberal and Republican, or liberal and conservative approaches to policy issues. So, you know, the catchphrase that was used for it during this time period was called triangulation. You know, I think maybe Dick Morris came up with that, but you know, the idea of kind of trying to pick this, you know, the less tactical way of saying it, and probably the way that the Clintonian Democrats would prefer, is that they called it the third way. You know, the left and the right, the idea that the left and the right were both discredited. So there was this third way that was, you know, not just, this is not just an American phenomenon, but, you know, you had Tony Blair in Britain doing much the same thing with the Labour Party, Gerhard Schröder in Germany at this time. You know, now he's a much different figure in his standing in the political firmament, but at that time was considered to be a kind of Clintonian figure among the you know, social democrats in Germany. And there are many other people who fit into this mold of liberal, you know, very, very, you know, broadly speaking, progressive, liberal on social policies, more free market oriented on economic policy. And you know, the party, the Democratic Party during this time period, I mean, almost pathologically during the Clinton era, would sort of take Republican ideas, you know, that have been developed at you know Heritage or you know, Manhattan Institute or you know, other places like that, and would kind of moderate them and put them into more to Democratic ears, more uplifting language, you know, around similar ideas, and would market them to Democratic voters. And this proved to be very successful. In fact, so successful that in 2000, because of some, you know, after losing a couple times to Bill Clinton, the George W. Bush and the Republican Party decided that they would try an approach that was much the same thing, coming from the right, taking what were taken to be liberal points of view, for instance, on immigration, coming up with approaches that were palatable to centrist Democratic voters, people who were living in the suburbs, people who are now voting in lockstep for the Democratic Party because of the subsequent realignment and political drift, but at this time we're much more up for grabs as voters. And so you had George W. Bush running in 2000 saying, you know, things like, you know, love and compassion doesn't end at the Rio Grande, and so on, things that were would be anathema in the, I think it's fair to say, in the Republican Party of Donald Trump, and being rewarded for it. And I guess, you know, so to say, so that's the historical roots of it. Now, that I think, you know, is, in my view, you know, it looks pretty good in comparison to our current political state of of polarization and endless fighting over over every single issue and sort of complete inability to for the legislative branch in particular to address important societal problems. The where I think you're right about it being a bad take is that, you know, ultimately a kind of cynicism set in, an idea that politics is really only about character, only the in characters that, you know, you, I'm using it in the 1990s meaning, which is basically a catchphrase meaning like likability or relatability, that you know, it, over time,
what not having sex scandals is not also having very sex scandals. Direct, yes. Well, because quick thing, because this is kind of your point. Half a huge part of the compassionate conservative George W. Bush triangulation was, hey, like we can be compassionate and centrist too. There just won't be any interns who are getting sexually harassed in the workplace. Like that's like the, like that is the direct use of character. Yeah. Basically, you could have the good parts of the 90s without the parts that we really didn't like on a couple of different levels.
Right. And I mean, and I think that, you know, that it was in part a function of, you know, in times of plenty and in times in which there aren't foreign threats. I think the necessary first condition for all of this was the end of the Cold War and the lack of geopolitical threat to the United States that really it didn't seem like as if any of these contests between the parties, between candidates, were all that, you know, consequential, to be honest. It's hard to like think back now to this time, you know, because we live in a time when it seems like you know, every election, whether it's for President of the United States or for, you know, Secretary of State of Georgia, or what have you, seems as if it has almost sort of existential level stakes attached to it. The idea, you know, there's an idea that it's not just policy that's up for grabs, but the very kind of fundamental tenets of the nation that are at stake oftentimes in these elections. And it's hard to cast your mind back to a time in which politics didn't seem that important, you know, or in which a sizable proportion of the American public felt as if either guy could be president and you know, things would be more or less kind of continuing on the same path. This is you know, one of the things that's the most jarring in the comparison between these two time periods is how could people be so complacent, and how could the American public actually think that the election of 2000 didn't matter? And the answer is that they didn't know why it would matter. They didn't know what was coming. And specifically, you know, in my book, it's the, you know, what's coming is represented by the 9/11 plot, which, you know, to talk a little bit about kind of like how the book is structured, you know, the central kind of construct of this book is looking at the coincidence, the historical coincidence that the recount and the contested election in Florida that determined the presidency by the most, you know, smallest margin imaginable, you know, happened in the same time and place, and oftentimes in like the same airspace as the training stages of the 9/11 plot. So the people who are going to change the world, the people who are going to change this political construct and in my view, break America, to bring us back to why I titled the book what I did, were right there. And they were witness to all this. And they were there living among us at that time. And to me, that's a really quite profound historical confluence that I wanted to explore deeper in the book.
Yeah, a million things I want to respond to with. One, I really resonate with your point about how it feels like the stakes. I think the stake, it's not just a feeling thing. The stakes are so high right now in the sense that, you know, it matters who the Arizona legislature elects this year because of the certification of the Electoral College issue. So in 2000, you have this time where there's just like, well, unironically, who would I rather have a beer with question that would help determine whether or not people voted certain ways, like my, you know, my grandmother, rest in peace. Like, she voted for George W. Bush as a 1990s Democrat because of the character issue, to your point. And now we're at a time where there's a legitimate conversation about, okay, like, what is Doug Mastriano, the Republican nominee for Pennsylvania? What is he going to do? What is the state legislator going to do in Arizona? It's really wild to see the stake and narrative shift there. But number two, I also appreciate how you helped me. I'm prone to overstatement. I've dialed back my criticism of people who thought the parties were too alike, in the sense that, given the way you just told the story, when it came to the big questions of the late 1990s, there wasn't that much daylight by the 1998 midterms, right? In the sense of, welfare needs to be reformed, the era of big government is over. Those were big 1990s questions. I think the issue was, and I think you captured this so well in the book, is that just like that, because of 9/11, frankly, that really expands outwards, the questions at hand shifted instantly, making the fact that the two parties were aligned on those 1998 questions just totally irrelevant. So the question in 2001 is no longer, hey, like, should we reduce the size of government now that the Cold War is over? It's no longer, hey, like, are we concerned that, like, the welfare system isn't quite in sync with the American nation's consensus now that we're kind of over the 1960s expansion of big government? That's the big question then. But I don't think everyone realized that the question to ask George W. Bush was not, are you going to continue with centrism? The question was going to be, let's say the US is attacked. Are you going to treat that as a police action? Are you going to treat it as a legal matter? As you point out, Janet Reno really was approaching it as, or are you going to launch a global war on terror that's going to reshape the entire geopolitical system? So that's just like that's my dialed back version. It's that when folks thought the parties were the same, it's not that they were crazy. It's that they were kind of focused on the wrong questions. And it's actually kind of to the detriment of Al Gore as a candidate that he didn't focus the election on the right question. What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And that's a, you know, the completely fair summation of my point of view on this. I mean, in fairness to Al Gore and even in fairness to George W. Bush, I mean, it would have been impossible to have the conversation about terrorism and what an attack to America would mean in the late 1990s, because it just was so incredibly unimaginable, inconceivable, the attack of 9/11, and it's, you know, this is a real generational thing too, because I think it's difficult for somebody who grew up in largely in a post 9/11 context to really fully understand what a complete and utter blow that was to the conception of you know, America's place in the world and everything, you know, that flowed out of it. I mean, just as you say, instantaneously, everything kind of changed. I mean, the only thing that can be kind of I feel like in my lifetime that really feels comparable in terms of just sort of fundamentally changing things, you know, is Trump's election in 2016. But even then, I mean, there was time to, you know, it was still shocking when it actually happened. But there was time to process the fact that it was, you know, a possibility, albeit a difficult to comprehend one. I think in the political context of, you know, 2015 and early 2016. Whereas 9/11 really just you know, kind of came out of nowhere. And as you say, you know, everything changed instantaneously.
And quick thing I want to add to that, because what's so interesting here, and once again, this is how you tell the story. In the late 90s, there were these little hints of what was coming in terms of 9/11. So there are the bombings in East Africa. Al Qaeda kills hundreds of Kenyans, mostly like U.S. like embassy staff that were foreigners, a couple Americans. Bill Clinton launches missiles at a factory in Sudan. You have Osama bin Laden like declaring war on the U.S. There's the USS Cole bombing in 2000. But they were just so small. They just weren't top of radar for basically anyone outside of the NatSec community. But the difference with 2016, I think to your point, is not only did you have some time to process it, but I think there was probably a much clearer indication that things were off, in the sense that, wait, it's 2014. Eric Cantor, the presumptive next Republican Speaker of the House, is taken out in a primary because he was too, let's say, centrist on the issue of immigration. Wait a second. The whole reason why he was going to the center on immigration was that the Republican Party thought, in order to come back from the Romney loss, that they needed to moderate in order to appeal more to Hispanic voters. So that's just like a quick narrative violation with the base and the party weren't lined up. You then have Brexit. You then have like Bernie Sanders challenging Hillary Clinton. There were just these quicker hints that just the status quo, Jeb Bush could be a nominee, Hillary Clinton could be a nominee thing. But with 9/11, there was nothing just so like punching you in the face in the same way.
Well, just to slightly, sort of nudge that in a little bit of a different direction, like those events, like the embassy bombings, the Cole attack, they were big deals. I mean, they were huge front page news. The threat of Al Qaeda was well known, but what the thing about that was so shocking about 9/11 was that, Al Qaeda was considered to be the most serious national security problem that the Clinton administration was dealing with. I mean, Bill Clinton told George W. Bush that this was, during the transition, that this was going to be the most vexing problem he was going to have to deal with. But the 9/11 attacks were such an unimaginably huge escalation of their ability to attack and to actually strike buildings that were part of the skyline and destroy them. It was just, it was sort of like, it was taking the scale of these events and just escalating our understanding of what our vulnerabilities were to such an amazing degree. I mean, at the time, the idea was, the comparison was to Pearl Harbor or something like that. But, nonetheless, I mean, Pearl Harbor was a sneak attack, but it wasn't a surprise to anyone that the United States got pulled into the war. This was really like, I think no one understood that it was possible for the United States to be attacked on its own soil in this incredibly, sophisticated isn't the right word because it was a pretty low tech attack, but in this incredibly damaging, coordinated way that was and I think this gets back to like some of the cultural elements of the book. It was a televised spectacle. It was a spectacle that was, created by people who understood how what we would now think of as, a social media event or a viral event, they understood how to create a spectacle that would be indelible in the public mind, they were fighting a different kind of war than we realized they were fighting.
I've got a good question from our producer, Aaron, on the site here. If you could say that the issue in today's politics, and people definitely feel this, is that there's too much polarization, could you argue that the issue in 2000 was there wasn't enough polarization in the sense that people didn't know the stakes enough? People weren't aware quite of what was actually up for grabs. Like, how would you think about this? Like, how polarized should or shouldn't people be?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a difference between, you know, being aware of and taking seriously the policy and ideological differences between candidates and the incredibly vicious and vitriolic political rhetoric that we now see. I think that, you know, and part of it is, you know, in 2000 at this time, I mean, I remember as a journalist, actually, ironically, the voice of this point of view in my book is not ironically, but perhaps foreshadowing the future. The voice of this perspective in my book is Michael Wolff, who at the time was a media critic at New York Magazine, where I now work. I didn't work there at the time. But he, you know,
And why have people heard the name Michael Wolff the past 4 years?
Well, Michael Wolff is, you know, the author of Fire and Fury and sort of the court chronicler of one of the many court chroniclers, but perhaps the most,
most entertaining, let's entertaining just put it that way.
Court chronicler of the Trump administration. So Michael Wolff at this time was a media critic for New York Magazine and was writing constantly during the recount. Just to recap very quickly the history here, you know, on election night, the election had been very boring up until election night. And then all of a sudden on election night, the whole thing comes down to Florida, comes down to a few thousand votes. There's a lot of excitement. There's goes back and forth. There's different time periods in which different people think that they've won, and it finally resolves itself that nobody knows who won. And so a whole bunch of lawyers end up going to Florida to fight for the presidency. This is the sort of the concluding third of my book. And, you know, Michael Wolff, the cynical media critic for the New York Magazine at the time, says like, oh, this is great. Finally, something that's entertaining in politics. We, you know, the other person who voices this point of view, Tucker Carlson, who probably needs no introduction, but he's gone on to be, you know, the highest rated host on Fox News. At this time, he was actually considered to be a quite centrist, mainstream, albeit conservative, but sort of a nice bow tie wearing intellectual conservative journalist who would write for New York magazines and so on. So in any case, both of these individuals are saying like, oh, this is sort of exciting. This is new. We haven't seen this before. And I think that, you know, I think that it's that sort of like in this moment, all of a sudden that this feeling in which the rules, the normal rules and the normal guardrails of political combat have been taken off, and all of a sudden the two parties are fighting in a kind of battle that nobody really has seen before or knows how it will turn out. This was like a very, you know, sort of exciting moment for a lot of people in the press. And a lot of us, to get back to my point of like, is polarization good or bad? A lot of us, I think at the time were like, wow, this is pretty fun. This is different. We haven't seen something like this before. And now every election is kind of like this. Every election feels like it's a 50-50 election. Every election feels like, you know, that. And the other thing that happened over the course of the recount, I should point out is that the formerly seemingly small differences between the candidates became, at least vis-a-vis the partisans for each candidate became much more vicious and much more kind of, it became this kind of, you know, fight to the death to determine who was going to hold the presidency. And this, again, is something that was exciting in the moment. Wow, we haven't seen this before, you know, a real political battle in which, you know, in which ruthlessness is rewarded and no, you know, and the mask of civility that the candidates sort of affect during the campaign is ripped off, and they're actually really going at each other in a real fight for power. All that seemed like kind of interesting and fun and different, and the kind of thing that people made movies about in the immediate aftermath and so on. But in retrospect, it now looks like a harbinger of the future. Every election's like that now. Every election feels like, you know, not just that every election feels as if, you know, each side feels that not only, it's not necessarily only to defeat the other side, but to kind of sow the fields with salt so that they can never run again. And so, you know, what in the moment felt as if it was a kind of a fresh, new, exciting kind of, we're living in interesting times. Well, you know, as the saying goes, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Another thing that comes to mind also is that, can you imagine, and this is just giving context, especially for the younger listeners who were not alive during this. Can you think of an election where an election is sleepier than Clinton versus Dole in 1996. I was doing a math. I'm like, in 20th century American politics, at least, I cannot think. Actually, let's just be fair and say post New Deal. Let's just keep it to that. That is just the sleepiest, least entertaining election that anyone could basically matter. Imagine at a core level there. Something that really comes to mind. I really appreciated your portraits of the main characters here on the politician side. And the thing that's going to be striking to any reader or listener is how young all the actual politicians are compared to the status quo. So, you know,
The status quo, there's largely, a lot of them are the same people.
Exactly. There's that dynamic. So there's something to be said there, but you know, Bill Clinton's 46 when he's elected. Al Gore was 44, I believe, when he was selected as vice president. George W. Bush is around the same age as Bill Clinton. So he was like a young, very young 50s when he's selected. But now, obviously, our political system, like it or not, it feels like it's a crew of 70-somethings. Really fighting to the death as they really leave the stage.
And also sort of like the bottom of the barrel, 70 somethings, right? Because yeah, the ones who are like actually, you know, possibly good at being president have already had their chance.
So, yeah. So
now we're getting the Joe Bidens of the world. So, who tried many, many times.
So here's what I'm curious about. So two questions here. Question one, what was it about this baby boom 40-something generation that enabled them to step up and take political power for the next 30 years? And what is it about, let's just say, their compatriots in the Gen X cohort? I'm saying this as like a mid-stage millennial. Why did they miss that opportunity? Because like, once again, like the 50-something, 40-something Democrats flamed out during the 2020 primary. Marco Rubio and co tried to do the young person, tried to do the young next generation thing in the 2015 Republican primary. What explains just the real difference between the rising boomers of the 90s and just the Gen Xers in the 2010s and early 2020s?
I don't know, man. It's been torturing me my entire life.
I wasn't gonna guess which cohort you're in, but if you want to out yourself and admit to your generational failure, you're more than welcome to.
I think one thing that is this isn't a new phenomenon, right? In the sense that the boomers felt like the greatest generation, the World War II generation, like stuck around way too long, right? So you had basically, you know, from Nixon onward, you know, you had it, or I mean, Kennedy onward, you had presidents that were all from that like World War II generation all the way through George H.W. Bush. They felt like they waited an awful long time to get power. And I guess, you know, that once they had it, that it was hard to dislodge. So I mean, part of it, I think, you know, just comes down to sheer numbers. Like there are fewer Gen Xers than there are, than there are boomers. But I think some of it, I have to say, I mean, you know, I'm just like thinking aloud now, but I mean, some of it may have to do with the fact that politics didn't necessarily seem like a high calling, right, in this time period in the 1990s and 2000s. It wasn't necessarily drawing in, because the stakes seemed relatively low, you know, maybe it wasn't necessarily drawing in the people who it might normally into public service. You know, if you were in the year 2000, if you wanted to change the world, like you didn't run for the House. You'd like started a internet startup, you know, and so the people who, you know, I think of as the most profound cultural forces out of that Gen X generation, they have had really profound influences on politics and the culture, but they've done it through non-political means, or non-explicitly non-electoral political means. So you've got, you know, we have a lot of, you know, we may not have a lot of power, but we have a lot of like, we have a lot of money and, or at least we have a lot of like control over the political discourse, I guess I'd say, in the sense of, you know, having invented these, you know, platforms in which, a lot of our political discourse for better or worse happens now.
That's actually a really astute point, because I'm sure, you know, there's this like broad Gen X field politics take, but now that I'm thinking about it, like in every other category you can imagine, you know, film, television, culture, technology, Gen Xers were incredibly accomplished. But somewhat to your point, it's also just and this is where this comes down to, sometimes you're just born at the wrong time. Maybe the time to be, oh, this is good. If you're in Gen X, it's a great time if you want to become a billionaire. You know, if you want to be a 22-year-old, and look at like Peter Thiel, talk about someone who's had a huge impact on our political system. Peter Thiel is on Stanford's campus during the dot-com boom and then becomes a billionaire and invests in Facebook. Great time to be that person. Would love to be at Palo Alto in the late 90s. Not a great time if you wanted to be a transformative politician in the political system.
Right. Yeah. And I think that, you know, this was very much in the culture. It's not like, it's not an accident that this happened. I mean, the idea that politics is not that Washington or politics is not someplace that you went if you really wanted to affect transformative change, that was communicated from the top on down. I mean, the idea, the era of big government is over, as you said, you know, probably one of the most famous Bill Clinton lines, you know, the era of big government, you know, also meant, I mean, big government meant, you know, big sclerotic, you know, bureaucratic government, but it also sort of meant the era of ambitious government was over. You know, the idea that all Clintonianism and what George W. Bush ran on were these ideas that you would nudge things incrementally in one direction or another, but that the American public didn't desire transformative change from their government. Well, so if you're a 25-year-old at that time, you know, and thinking about how am I going to make transformative change, and your president and presidential candidates are saying, like, don't look to Washington for it, Well, you know, like maybe you go, you know, I think there are a lot of people out in Palo Alto who are saying like, yeah, we love transformative change. And in fact, we're doing it right now, and you can do it right this second, you know, in your garage, you know, to use the cliche. I mean, so I think that, I think that you know, this idea that Gen X has failed is not necessarily, I mean, it succeeded on the terms that were set out at the time that my generation started its progression through life. And what we were told was that if you wanted to make change in the world, it was unlikely that the government was going to bring it to you. And it was, there was also a complacency. I mean, to go back to the idea of the year that broke America, right? There's also complacency to it. There was a sense that American ideas and the underpinnings of American, you know, the American democratic idea were so powerful that they would just triumph on their own. We had witnessed in the late 1980s the complete fall for no particular reason that, you know, that you could see. Like, no, there was no, you know, the communism.
You didn't see, to your point about like the internet changing things, you did not see the Soviet system break down in real time as you would today. You just wake up one day, I'm sure, and you're like, wait a second, like, wait, the republics are breaking up, the Berlin Wall is down. I'm sure that just felt, talk about like an instantaneous reaction thing.
Yeah, and so there's an idea that it wasn't these American democratic ideas and the globalist economic policy and so on, that these were unchallenged and unchallengeable ideas that would just sort of triumph on their own. And so, like, why, if you're a young person, like, why would you run for office to advance them? They're doing fine. You know, they triumphed over the communist system without even firing a shot. And our enemies, you know,
wanted to be more like us. Gorbachev's in the Pizza Hut ad. Which is still crazy. If people want to fund YouTube, search Gorbachev Pizza. You know, like, you're the literal former head of the Soviet Union is hawking, you know, mediocre 1990s pizza capitalism, right? Like, that's, if you want to see what the end of history looks like, it's probably that video. You know, just a reflection, then like a final big question before we hit the hour. What I think is so depressing about what you're saying is that your articulation of, you were told generationally that if you want to make a difference, go somewhere else. What's depressing about that is I think that's an accurate summation of like the current system today. In the sense that, like, if you wake up every day and you're driven by a need to like systematically change, or like beyond just like obvious technocratic things, like reimagine the American political system and political life and this or that, like, I do not think getting elected to the current Congress is going to actually help you. I think the difference is there's still, that opportunity still existed in the 1990s. And because of just this complacency, people act as if that wasn't there. So I think it's this weird feeling of this message was probably transmitted and imbibed at the wrong moment. And now it's actually just accurate. But the question is, like, was that always inevitable? Or is that just a combination of these things? What I want to close with then is your most like news you can use aspect for people, because this comes through your articulation of the problem the Democrats faced in the 1990s. So all indications are that Democrats are going to get totally wrecked, to be really technical about it, in 2022, despite coming into office with all this ambition and all this hope. This is Bill Clinton in 1992 when he defeats George H.W. Bush. Joe Biden had a similar opportunity or dynamic. And what Bill Clinton chose to do was, Bill Clinton, to your point, chose triangulation. Bill Clinton said, look, this is a center-right country. JFK is my hero, but I'm not JFK. I am going to reconcile as much of the right with left goals as possible and basically just give up on ambitious projects. Hillary Care was not the right call. Joe Biden's going to face a similar choice going into 2023 when it comes to his presidency. I think it's very easy in retrospect to critique Clintonian triangulation and centrism as like unambitious and neoliberal. But I think usually those critiques understate the real political disaster that he was facing if he didn't make those moves. So with that in mind, like what do you think that story means for Joe Biden now that he's in a similar dynamic that Bill Clinton was?
Well, I think unfortunately for Joe Biden, Biden's in has a much more difficult situation, which is to say, you know, triangulation between Newt Gingrich, Republicanism, and Bill Clinton, Democratic, you know, Democratic Leadership Council, centrist Democrat ideology, as much as it seemed like a kind of revolution, to use Gingrich's own terminology in 1994 when they took power, it was possible to foresee a way in which the Democratic Party or Democratic president could take some of these ideas, like reforming welfare, or to take one that looks less good in retrospect, you know, getting tough on crime, three strikes and you're out, you know, these sorts of things that I think in retrospect, you know, a lot of people from the right and left have come to the conclusion were poorly thought out policies. But at the time, they were quite popular, and there were areas in which the Republicans and Democrats could find like a place to meet in the middle. It's going to be, I mean, I just don't, I don't foresee a scenario in which, you know, a Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, with like a very emboldened Freedom Caucus, and a, you know, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell with, you know, a very emboldened group of senators led by, you know, Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and others, are gonna have places in which they can meet Joe Biden on policy, in part because our current system, the divisions in our current system, to me seem less policy based than they are cultural. You know, there's been this realignment within the parties. I mean, I think the big story over the course of the last decade or more has been the sort of realignment of the parties, partly along geographic lines, but also along class and education lines. You know, you now have a Democratic Party that has lost touch with you know, huge swaths of the working class that it used to speak to and used to rely on, you know, union voters and in the Northeast and the Midwest, and similarly, you have a Republican Party that you know, may well have permanently alienated a lot of suburban voters, especially women in the suburbs who, you know, formerly would have voted Republican on economic or you know, other social cultural issues, but are probably lost forever because of the tone of the Republican Party on a lot of these cultural issues and frankly things like Roe v. Wade. So you've had this like realignment where the two parties not only they don't disagree so much ideologically, although they do disagree on ideology, but they're actually really culturally opposed to one another, in a way that they it's not a matter of finding common ground on some legislation where you split the difference between the two parties. It's really a matter of, you know, I don't want you to win, because if you win, I lose, or I feel as if, you know, my tribe is losing face vis-a-vis, you know, yours. And ultimately the goal is for my tribe to keep control of the government. So this is like a really, this is something that starts in 2000. I mean, part of what I write about in this book is about how these cultural currents that would lead to our current cultural and political polarization were just starting to happen at the time. But it's really tough to see how President Biden would find a third way. I suspect that after, you know, if, as I think you correctly predict, that there's a major defeat for the Democrats in 2022, I suspect that there will be quite strong pressure on Biden not to run again. And it's possible that this next election looks more like, you know, 1968 than it looks like 1996. Unfortunately for the Democrats, I just think that the President Biden was elected really to do one thing. He accomplished it the day that he took the oath of office. And after that, the Democratic Party has, you know, sort of didn't really know what to do next. And I think they're still looking for somebody who can compellingly tell the American public like what it is that they want to do besides not be Donald Trump.
Yeah. And just to close, because I want to respond to, I think, your useful bit at the start here. The flaw with analogizing 1995 after the Republican midterm win to today, to your point, is the questions that the political system was engaging on were ones where triangulation was an option. So the question isn't, do we have welfare in this country or do we not have welfare? The question was, okay, like, what should it look like? How long can you get welfare? Does it expire? Should we rename the title? Like, those questions are ones that could be triangulated. Questions of, is it too easy to vote in this country, or is it not easy enough to vote, or is it not, or is it like not easy? Is it too hard to vote in this country? Those ones do not have this, like, triangulation doesn't work because it's just very binary. And let's just say that, you know, when you're adding non-binary questions to cultural polarization and a disastrous economy, it's hard to see. You're not going to be able to slick Willy Bill Clinton your way out of that one. So I think that's a great way to close it. Like, once again, like, Andrew, really enjoyed speaking with you. We've kept this conversation very meta, but I think in each of the different stories you're telling in the book, I think the broader vibe we're discussing here really comes out. So I can't recommend it enough.
All right. Thanks so much. I really appreciate you. Great conversation.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.